from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum in the hour ahead, Samuel Zamuri was a poor Jewish immigrant selling freckled bananas out of a boxcar before amassing a fortune in the banana trade. His rags-to-riches story is unveiled in a new biography by Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone magazine contributing editor Rich Cohen. Cohen joins us to discuss Zamuri's life in relation to American capitalism, foreign relations in Latin America, and beyond after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Samuel Zamuri was a poor Russian, 6'3", Jewish immigrant who came as a youth to the United States, actually to Selma, Alabama, from Western Russia back in 1892, and peddled out of a pushcart until he began to make money, big money, selling bananas. His extraordinary life, from fruit peddling and selling bananas off the side of a boxcar at rail stations to toppling foreign governments and heading up United Fruit for 3 decades, is chronicled for us in Rich Cohen's new book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Rich Cohen is a contributing editor at both Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone and is the author of Sweet and Low, Tough Jews, and Israel is Real. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, Harper's Magazine, and Best American Essays. And he joins us for this Forum Hour. Good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
I'd begin by saying many of my associations, probably like listeners, if your memory goes back far enough, with bananas is Chiquita Banana or Yes, We Have No Bananas or things of that sort. But here you learn about bananas and toppling governments and CIA intrigue, and it's pretty extraordinary story. Also, I didn't know a banana was a berry or... I learned all kinds of things here, that we sell more bananas in this country now than apples or oranges combined. But let's talk about this character of Samuel Zamuri. You see him as a kind of American archetype, don't you?
I think his life, as much as any life, sort of represents America in the 20th century. If you look at his career, the length of it, at the beginning of it in the 1890s when he was selling overripe bananas on the wharfs of Mobile, Alabama.
Because freckles bananas. Yeah.
Two freckles becomes a ripe and they went to Zamuri. Everybody else considered him garbage and he believed if he hustled enough he could sell them before they turned to rot. And it's like a John Ford movie. It's like he goes down to Central America. It's like the Wild West. There's guys they call banana cowboys who are just like the guys in Tombstone, Arizona. You have to deal with them. You have to fight with them or against them. There are guys like Lee Christmas and Machine Gun Maloney, and it's just a whole other era. It's the era you really only know from old, you know, Western novels and dime store novels. And at the end, in the 50s, he's involved with toppling the government of Guatemala with the CIA and Howard Hunt and John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles and Dwight Eisenhower. So it sort of starts when America's a regional power and it's a John Ford Western. It's a wild bunch. And it ends and America's a superpower. It's the middle of the Cold War. It's a Cuban Missile Crisis, and it's the spy who came in from the cold. And I think his life is that story lived, you know, by one person.
He's got the three Johns here, John Wayne, John Rockefeller, and John Le Carre. But I'm also struck by the fact that, I mean, we get to Guatemala here. I mean, and when you tell his story, it brings in the Dulles brothers. It brings in Cuba and Castro and the Dominican Republic, but also started out really in Honduras, bribing officials and doing all that sort of thing. Doing some pretty underhanded stuff, but then realizing that maybe he needed his own government to fight against the likes of J. Pierpont Morgan.
Right. Well, the first thing is, you know, Honduras means the depths, which is what the conquistadors called it. But in reality, it's very shallow there. So it's false advertising from the beginning. Nothing is as it seems. And Zamuri went down to Honduras. He wanted to grow his own bananas after he'd made money being a fruit peddler, basically, a lot of money. And the way the business worked, it worked on this thing called concessions, the whole banana business, which is you'd go around and you'd bribe everybody so you could grow your bananas without paying any tax on equipment or your exports. And the whole business was based on incredibly cheap bananas. And if you had to pay tax, it blew your model. You went out of business. So Murray bought all this land for very little money in Honduras and basically set up a whole system of bribes and was all ready to go, you know, to get into business when Honduras ran into trouble. Honduras was like Greece is today. It had this huge, massive debt. it owed to the British banks. And the U.S. government came in. The Secretary of State was this guy named Philander Knox, working with J.P. Morgan himself, not the bank, but the guy, to come in and buy off the British debts and refinance Honduras' debt and sort of take over the country. So if you came into the country, you had to pay tax right to the Morgan bank officers. They take their cut and give the rest to the government. It would ruin Zemurray's business. Zemurray tried to overturn this plan. The Secretary of State told him to knock it off, told him to stay in New Orleans where he lived, not leave New Orleans. And none of his cohorts could leave New Orleans and cause, you know, be mischievous in Honduras. And he got a group of mercenary soldiers that he recruited from the Carousel Bar on Royal Street in the Hotel Monteleone in the French Quarter, still an excellent bar.
And there's a gunboat in this called the Hornet, too, right?
That's right.
I mean, I mentioned that because later on when he was United Fruit, they had a navy of their own. I mean, the story gets the proportions of it and the dimensions of it are amazing. I mean, you just kind of nicely told initially what he did in Honduras. But the big story, of course, was Guatemala.
Right. Well, he in Honduras with these mercenary soldiers, he overthrew the government. And he put in his own president. And his own president's first rule was Samuel Zemurray doesn't pay tax in Honduras for 25 years. And that was the ground on which he built his banana company, which is called Coyumel Fruit, on the Coyumel River on the north coast of Honduras. Right across the river was Guatemala. And the border was in dispute. And Guatemala was the property, really, or property is probably the right term and the wrong term, of the United Fruit Company, which was El Pulpo, the octopus. Hugo Chavez is still complaining about it, and it doesn't even exist anymore.
Frank Norris talked about the railroad as that, but this right. was the fruit company. What do they own, about 80% of the land? In Guatemala?
Guatemala, they would ultimately own 70% of the private land as well as the Pacific ports.
Amazing. And he didn't like things that were going on in Guatemala either, I mean, in terms of his business enterprise.
Well, there was just a little bit of banana land left, so he and United Fruit were fighting over the land, and the land was disputed, like whose property was it, Honduras or Guatemala? So their fight for the remaining land became a hot war with these vaqueros, these armies of banana cowboys, actually shooting at each other, and these private navies, United Fruit had the largest private navy in the world, shooting at each other, and it almost became an actual war between Guatemala and Honduras, and that's how rough it was down there.
It's also rough in the sense of there was a lot of bloodshed as a result of this interference in Guatemala, and there's probably, I think it's safe to say, without sounding like one is too hyperbolic, that this was someone who has a lot of blood on his hands.
Yeah, well, to me, Zemurray lived one of those huge, huge lives. It's like King David. You know, there was the young Zemurray, the middle-aged Zemurray, and the old Zemurray, and they have different stages of his life. In the 1930s, he took over United Fruit. That was a corporate takeover, a coup. United Fruit bought
him out. That's your title.
Yeah, that's where the title comes from, the fish that ate the whale, which is what the New York Times called him. United Fruit bought out his company with stock, mostly to get rid of him, made him sign a non-compete clause and retire in New Orleans. He didn't like what was happening with the company. It's sort of every businessman in this country's fantasy. They sell out to the behemoth. They don't like how the behemoth is running the company. They come back and take over the whole thing. And that's what he did. And then as the head of United Fruit, he became the head of everything. They had land in Cuba, Ecuador, Costa Rica, Guatemala.
Built a railroad in Costa Rica, in fact.
That's how the company
tried to build a railroad,
started.
Yeah.
They built the first intercontinental road across Costa Rica and started planting bananas along the sides of the tracks.
And they were involved in the Bay of Pigs?
Well, that was after Zemurray retired. He got very old. He had Parkinson's disease. But Zemurray overthrew the government of Honduras with a group of banana cowboys, right? Then he overthrew the government of Guatemala in 1954 with the CIA, the company did. And then they attempted to do the same thing post-Zemurray, but the same plan in Cuba. And they gave the CIA the guns and the ships and a lot of the money for the Bay of Pigs. United Fruit grew sugar in Cuba. It was the largest property holder. They had all their land nationalized by Castro. Castro, whose father worked for United Fruit. So it's sort of like all these lines intersect. Also, Lee Harvey Oswald worked for United Fruit in New Orleans.
I know. I mean, there are so many dots that connect here. It's fascinating. We're talking with Rich Cohen, whose new book is The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. And it's all about this, amazing character. I mean, he was entrepreneurial. He was Horatio Alger. He was up from poverty. It's a real American success story. But also, as I said, I mean, he was a racist. He was a guy who was, as we said, almost really responsible for thousands of deaths in Guatemala. And they call him El Gringo throughout Central America. He had that nomenclature.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about him is as bad as he might look to us, he was better than what came before. He was much better than United Fruit had been, which was all Boston Brahmins, you know, up in Massachusetts. He actually lived in Honduras. He spoke Spanish. He was famous as being the guy who could swear in five different languages. He actually improved a lot of United Fruit's racist policies. I would think he really wasn't, he was of his time, you know. But compared to United Fruit, he was a huge improvement. So the strange thing is Zemurray is not hated in Central America the way United Fruit is. People carve out a slight distinction because he lived there. And he was with people there. He hung out in the bars. That made him a great businessman. He hung out in the cantinas. He knew the people. And his a lot of his grandkids, great-grandkids are basically Central Americans now. So there's a slight difference. What's so interesting about him is not that he's this villain and not that he's a hero, but he's like really a human being on an epic scale. And to me, it's the American dream because here's all the good stuff. You know, the Horatio Alger, the land of opportunity. He's like the equivalent. It's almost,
and a major philanthropist.
And a major philanthropist, especially in Central America and in New Orleans at Tulane, which I went to. That's how I know about him, where he's known. And, you know.
And you have the biggest house in New Orleans and is now the home of the president of New Orleans?
Two Audubon Place and St. Charles Avenue. It's beautiful. I don't know if it's the biggest because the last 30 years people have built insane houses.
And Rice built a pretty big house.
Right.
But, I mean, the story has so many wrinkles to it. I mean, you provide, as you usually do, really a compelling narrative here. But I guess the real thing we need to understand about him was that United Fruit was probably, from your perspective, and you're the historian here, as big in its way as Google is now, and that this was a guy who was so connected to the American government. I mean, the Banana Republic is really something that emerged from his work, from his entrepreneurship and his bringing bananas here.
Yeah, the term Banana Republic was from Honduras, coined by O. Henry, who was hiding out in Honduras because he had absconded from money from a bank and there was no extradition treaty.
This is a famous short story right
now.
Yeah,
his first book was about that country and that the term Banana Republic appears in the country. But he, you know, he became so powerful. You know, it is the equivalent of a guy who starts pumping gas for ExxonMobil station on 95. 25 years later, he owns ExxonMobil. I mean, that's what Zemurray did, the length of his rise, and that's admirable. I mean, that's the American dream. But the thing is, when you have your dreams, sometimes it's nightmare for other people. You know, so he's living out his fantasy kind of in Honduras and Guatemala. But if you're little Gabriel Garcia Marquez growing up in Colombia in a United Fruit town, it's not a dream. It's a nightmare.
He also was, the DOJ went after him with an antitrust suit, too. I mean, there was some pressure from the government, despite the fact that he was so in league with, it was almost like Bush and Halliburton.
That's a perfect analogy. I mean, the DOJ went after really United Fruit before Zemurray, and they went after him again after Zemurray. United Fruit was always careful to try to get 49% in any market. They never wanted to go down on antitrust. But one of their strategies was they hired people from the very top of the American government, or people would go through what you now call the revolving door. So the interests of United Fruit and the U.S. government seemed to be the same because they were so blurred. So John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State in 1954 during Guatemala, had done all the contracts between United Fruit and Guatemala when he worked for Sullivan Cromwell, a law firm in New York. When he left, a lot of the contracts were done by his little brother, Alan Dulles, who in 1954 was the head of the CIA, the second head of the CIA. The first head of the CIA was Beadle Smith, who became president of United Fruit after he left the CIA. He said because he loved all the pretty white sailing ships. Dwight Eisenhower's private secretary husband was United Fruit's head of in-house public relations, and United Fruit's head of outside public relations was Edward Bernays.
Yeah, let's talk about him. This is Freud's nephew, who's sort of the king of PR.
He invented the term PR. Before that, you've been a press agent like a hack, and he made you like a doctor.
But here was the Cold War, and here's Zemurray concerned about what might be happening in Guatemala, so he's able to use PR planning stories about how Guatemala is going communist, essentially.
Yeah, Edward Bernays had this idea, philosophy called indirection, which is you don't directly sell something. So you don't. The problem was after World War II, Jacobo Arbenz, the president of Guatemala, started nationalizing a bunch of United Fruit's property because they owned 70% of the private land, a lot of it just fallow, nothing growing on it. And Bernays looked at the problem and said, okay, so the way you deal with this problem is you don't go after this president. You convince the American people and the American government that they've gone communist. The guy's a communist, and they represent a toehold of the Soviet Union in the Western Hemisphere. And then the U.S. government sort of takes care of your problem. Bernays always said that he believed it. Later on, he sort of apologized for it, but he said he believed that Jacobo Arbenz was a communist. Turns out Jacobo Arbenz wasn't a communist, but ultimately in 1954, the CIA, using Zemuri's model from Honduras with just a few guys, overthrew the government of Guatemala. That set off the situation you're talking about, where you had a decades-long civil war where ultimately that country was destabilized and over 100,000 people died.
Talking again with Rich Cohen, who is contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone magazine. His most recent book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. And this is a natural for a film. I think Daniel Plainview in There Will Be Blood kind of may have beaten you to the punch here. It's a very different story, but it's a similar kind of story in terms of that archetype.
Yeah, and I always thought Daniel Day-Lewis would be a perfect Zemuri. I mean, I think the difference is that Zemuri did have a family. Family was important to him, and he was not so alone. And also, one of the things about Zemuri, for whatever you might think about him, is you sense that he was a guy who was having fun in a way. You know what I mean? He would go down to Honduras, and Honduras, you lived in these banana compounds, which were like little cutout versions of the United States, and it was a good life. You know, John Wayne used to take his boat down there and just dock down there so he could play cards for 2 weeks, and Lindbergh would come through, and it was this strange other world where these guys from Boston and from New Orleans would go down and live half the year, kind of a fantasy of the last frontier, and they called it the banana frontier. It's sort of the last vestige of Rudyard Kipling's imperial world in the Western Hemisphere.
And there's even a connection to Kingfish, Huey Long, when we talk about Zemuri's story. I mean, you seem to think that he may have been involved in the assassination.
Well, I don't think he was involved in this assassination. I just remarked. See, Zemuri, after he sold out to United Fruit, he agreed to not compete with the company, not start another banana company. And he went back to New Orleans very rich, worth $30 million during the Depression, to sort of retire and do whatever he would do. And he ended up in this huge battle with Huey Long, because I think he recognized in Huey Long a version of a European dictator. And it was the Depression. There were a lot of people out of work. And he saw this as very dangerous. Zemuri was a big liberal, which might surprise some people. And he was very close to Roosevelt. And Long was talking about running against FDR. And so he became Zemuri's enemy, and Zemuri backed his political opponents. And Long, who was a paranoid guy, but just because you're paranoid, you know, doesn't mean you don't have enemies, was obsessed with this idea that Zemuri was going to do what he did in Honduras in Louisiana. He was going to overthrow the government of Huey Long and replace him with his own hand-picked guy, who was a mayor of New Orleans. And this feud built to a boil between Long and Zemuri, to the point where Long made only one speech in his whole career about foreign affairs. It was about Zemuri, denouncing Samuel Zemuri in Central America. And then right when it reached a boil, Huey Long was assassinated. I'm not saying Zemuri had anything to do with it. I'm just saying that everybody who treated Zemuri badly, humiliated him, got in his way, had a habit of coming to a bad end.
Talking again with Rich Cohen, who has written a book about a man who was obviously larger than life. I'd like to invite those of you listening to join this conversation. Some of you may have questions about Samuel Zemuri because perhaps you've never even heard of him. That was the case with me. But there's so much here about what I'm talking about is a kind of American archetypical story of someone who is a success up from the bootstraps, an American immigrant who comes here and winds up playing an extremely prominent role, not only in terms of foreign policy, but American relations with other countries and really what goes on internally in those other countries. I'd like to hear from you if you'd like to join the conversation. Some of you may have some questions or comments. Some of you may even know about Samuel Zemuri, particularly any of you who are listening in New Orleans or who are from New Orleans. We do welcome your contributions to the conversation. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us at that number now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or simply go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page, a number of ways to join and become interactive with us. And we do, as I said, welcome that. There's also, you talked about his philanthropic work, and he had a lot to do with bringing some pressure on the resolution about Israel. I mean, he played a role in that as well, and also helping refugees escape from World War II.
Well, it's interesting because he was Jewish, but both his children were married in churches or chapels. And so being Jewish wasn't so important to him. You know, you learn about Jews have freedom in America, and one of the freedoms, it turns out, is to stop being Jewish. And a lot of them took that freedom. You know, that's the ultimate freedom for some people. But early on,
one of his only regrets in life that he didn't raise his children Jewish.
I sort of got that feeling, yeah, at the end, and from stories that I heard about the fact that his grandson wasn't Jewish, and he sort of had a role in raising his grandson, Samuel Zimri III. And you know, I think what happened with him, though, is early on in the 1920s, when he'd first had a lot of money, Chaim Weizmann, who would become the first president of Israel and is considered responsible for the Balfour Declaration, came to the United States looking to raise money, and he heard that there's this incredibly rich Russian Jewish banana king living in New Orleans, and he went down, and they had sort of this soul connection and became very close. And after that, Zimri gave a lot of money to that cause, and it's unclear to me how much she really believed in the cause or how much it was a personal thing with Weizmann. But during the 30s, when Jews were trapped in Europe, I really think he had this ability to look at those people and not only say, that could be me, because he was Russian, but in a sense, a Russian Jew, that is me. And he was involved in helping getting those people out of some people out of Europe and into the Dominican Republic and eventually to the United States. And then later on, he was involved in helping get people, getting ships to carry Jewish refugees to Palestine. And then in the resolution that divided Palestine into two states, there was actually – people don't know this. They know there was a resolution, but there were actually two votes. You needed two-thirds majority at the UN to sort of create the state of Israel. The first vote failed. But it was so close, they scheduled the second vote 72 hours later. And in that moment, Weizmann, according to diaries, some by Weizmann, came to Zimri and said, we need you now more than ever. And he was in New Orleans at that house, at 2 Audubon Place, and he got on the phone and he sort of called every leader where bananas were king, and he saw whose vote could be moved. And ultimately, just enough votes either went from no to abstain or from abstain to yes to carry the resolution. So if you go look at the countries who voted to partition Palestine, it's very strange because there's a bunch of countries like Ecuador that make no sense. Why do they care? They don't have a dog in that fight. But it does make sense if you know that behind it is Samuel Zimri with his big pile of ripes on his pushcart.
And also pressuring in Dominican, for example, he really brought some pressure to bear that brought the vote in.
Yeah, and it was easy for United Fruit to bring pressure because United Fruit in some countries actually delivered the mail. That's how powerful they were. They owned the
literally,
railroads.
Yes.
They literally delivered the mail. They could shut countries down.
What do we learn about capitalism from Samuel Zimri?
I mean, in Zimri, you see capitalism in its truly raw form. And by the way, this is still what goes on. I mean, you read about Walmart in Mexico and the bribes that they paid and everything. It's exactly the same. It's sort of capitalism without rules. And what you learn is an incredible amount of wealth can be created and big things can be built. But the flip side of that, there's a lot of destruction, a lot of pain.
Well, we'll bring our listeners into this conversation. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. Continue this discussion with Rich Cohen. Again, his book is The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Rich Cohen, who is contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. His most recent book is called The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. It's the story of Samuel Zimri, who was a poor Jewish immigrant, sold freckled bananas out of a boxcar before he amassed a fortune in the banana trade. And his rags-to-riches story is unveiled in this new biography by Rich Cohen. This would make a really great movie in many respects. So if you can't use Daniel Day-Lewis, who else comes to mind?
I'm thinking Sacha Baron Cohen could do his first legit role, and he could play the young Sam Zimri, and Brad Pitt could play the head of the mercenary army, Lee Christmas.
Oh, he was head of that army in Quentin Tarantino's, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Army of Nazi fighters or Nazi killers. Patrice writes, Cleveland connection. I believe there was a link to the Cleveland Trust Bank and the Rockefellers. Any comment? My husband has many relatives who were executives at United Fruit in the 50s.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because United Fruit was a Boston company and was really connected to the First Bank of Boston. And the chairman of the board was a guy, Daniel Gould Wing, who was president of the First Bank of Boston. And Zemurray was and Zemurray's company was a New Orleans company. So that's more of a United Fruit connection. What's interesting is when Zemurray took over the company, he went up to give a speech. He was the largest shareholder, but he didn't control the company. He had 30% of the stock or something. And he went up. He had a very thick Russian accent. The joke was Samuel Zemurray spoke with no accent except when he swore, but that was all the time.
Yeah, he was a prolific user of profanity in five languages.
And he went up and he gave this speech to the head to the board of directors, all these Boston Brahmins, about what the company needed to do. And Daniel Gould Wing looked at him and said, "I'm sorry, I can't understand a word you just said." And everybody burst out laughing, and he laughed, and he came back with the proxies, and he said, "You're all fired. Did you understand that?" And that's how he became the fish that ate the whale. So when he took over the company, he sort of took on all the evils of United Fruit, which really was kind of an evil company, more than Zemurray's company, I think. So all those connections really predate and are inherited by Zemurray more than he was responsible for.
Now, he grew up on a wheat farm.
In Western Russia, Bessarabia, he grew up on a wheat farm. That's a whole weird, interesting story why there were Jews farming wheat in Western.
Not too many Jewish people in agriculture in that area.
The Russians basically took them from Poland and settled them on this land, thinking if we're attacked by the Turks, they'll run over these Jews and that will slow them down for a couple of days.
Well, nothing seemed to slow down Zemurray. Let me go to our callers here. We got our first caller, Peter from Berkeley. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a somewhat alternative view of Sam Zemurray. I'm actually part of his Jewish family, and I traveled to Latin America with the person I called. I knew him as Uncle Sam. He was my mother's uncle. So he was a figure that I had conflated with the poster of Uncle Sam Wants You. I don't know if you remember
that. Yeah, of course. Famous poster for the American Army.
Right. And to me, he was an aloof but very kindly man. And one of my first memories, well, he used to come to visit us in Boston. My stepfather was, we were living in Boston, and my stepfather was going to school at Harvard Law School at the time. And he had worked for Zemurray on the docks. And we would, and his family also, his father had married Sam. It was a family kind of thing. There were more fruit merchants. These were from the Midwest. But the point about Zemurray really is that he certainly was Jewish. His wife, Sarah, who I called Aunt Sarah, had written cookbooks for kosher Southern cooking. So they were very definitely identified as Jews. And they also had a big problem of anti-Semitism in the world, corporate world of United Fruit, where Sam could not relax very much or be, he was always under scrutiny as a Jewish outsider.
I know Peter. How you doing, Peter?
Hi, Rich. Yes.
I have a question for you, actually, something I always found really fascinating about your uncle, which is in New Orleans, you know, was a lot of German Jews, and your uncle was a Russian Jew.
Right.
And did you ever hear stories about what it was like for him with the German Jewish community in that city?
I'm not sure about that, Rich. I went down there to meet some of those people, and I've always stayed with Sam's in-laws, the Hirsches. And Hirsch could be a German Jewish name. They didn't make a big distinction about that. They were clearly Jews, and they belonged to the synagogue.
Right.
Temples. But it wasn't the major thing. It was yes, they were Jews, but they were much more. Was there, in terms of Sam anyway, Sam was a political progressive. He was for the working man.
Right. What I always found so interesting was that, you know, New Orleans has this very old Jewish community, one of the oldest in the country, I think. And it really was Sephardic Jews and then German Jews. And they set up clubs like the Harmony Club. And when the Russian Jews came in, it was like a bit like in the whole country, really. It was the same
thing. Keep them out.
keep them out because they would ruin everybody's reputation. And I interviewed some of the people like Thomas Lemon, who worked for your uncle, and he would talk about how Sam Zamora was a great man, so great that he didn't care that he wasn't allowed in places like the Harmony Club, which was a Jewish club. And just sort of fascinating to me, all the various shades of distinction between different people that, if you weren't Jewish, would all seem this sort of the same to you.
Well, of course, a great line of Groucho Marx has come to mind. Who would want to join a club that wanted? <didn't>. Peter, thank you. Good to hear from you this morning. And a couple of web comments that are critical. Let me read them and get your response, Rich Cohen. Here's Tony, who says, a sick story about a man who played a key role in a sick period of American history. Why this American success story should be of interest to us is beyond me. Ask the people who died as a result of this man's vile and predatory machinations how they feel about his so-called success. I doubt they are very much enamored of it. And another listener, Christine, says, leave it to a Vanity Fair contributor to spin the life of a piranha as an admirable example of the American dream. I guess the recent financial debacle suggests that dream is alive and well.
Right. Well, I didn't say it's admirable. I said it's the American dream. You know, I said that it's both sides of the American dream, and there's a lot of damage and evil done. But the thing about it is there's a tendency to judge everything through today's eyes. And the thing about Zamora that I thought was so interesting was he didn't invent the banana business. He was the lowest rung of the banana business and worked his way up. And that was how the banana business was done, by United Fruit and even companies that came before United Fruit. And he entered without question the game that was being played. Getting overly incensed about Sam Zamora to me is a little bit like getting mad at a football coach from the 1950s because of concussions. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and the thing about Zamora that was interesting was at the end of his life, he did realize, I believe, the evil that they had done, and there was a tremendous amount of regret. That's why he gave away most of his money in Central America. He sold all his United Fruit stock, which is a statement. But these people who write in, they're right. I mean, they're absolutely right, too. That's what's interesting about it. And it's not that this is some weird, odd, outlandish story of America. This is the American story. That's what is interesting about it. Because at the same point,
Jay Gatsby all over again,
yes,
in a different way?
I mean, yeah. That's it. It's completely complicated. You build this incredible country and you build over and destroy the nations that were here before you without even realizing what you're doing. It's like one generation builds and destroys and the next generation lives on the wealth created while criticizing what was done in the previous generation. That's American history. That's why Sam Zamora, though he was born in Russia, is to me the ultimate American. He did again in his one life what America did in 250 years. You know, and yes, it's terrible and everything else, but that's what's fascinating about it, which is it is our story.
It's like trying to separate Thomas Jefferson from being a slave owner.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me get more calls here. Malcolm joins us from up in Cotati. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I always listen to your show, but so much of this that you're talking about seems to relate to me in some ways. My grandfather was Samuel Cohen, Rich, as it happens to be, and he was a Russian immigrant, one of the youngest of 11 children, ended up in Springfield, Massachusetts, made what we were told as his grandchildren a fortune in what was called the tobacco cloth industry and tobacco, and he did it by reselling these cloths that they placed over tobacco in the curing process and then leasing them back to the larger companies, but he ended up utilizing a lot of the same tactics I'm told in Cuba, and as we moved to Miami, he was an importer of Cuban tobacco, and I was wondering if you saw any parallels there in those tactics from that standpoint. There's a famous story we're told in our family about how he was smuggled out of Cuba in a casket with some of his fortune when Castro took over the country there. And, you know, the tie-ins between government and politics and things like that, if you saw any parallels there.
Yeah, I mean, all these stories to me remind me of a Yogi Berra line, which is Yogi Berra is told that a Jew is elected mayor of Dublin, and he said, only in America.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's like what I hear from your grandfather's story and Zamora that is really what these stories are about. First of all, is sort of what I think of as kind of immigrant eyes, seeing value where other people see only garbage, which has to do with growing up in
the
time.
The whole dry goods industry, really.
Yeah. I mean, Zamora went down to Mobile, Alabama, and he watched what Boston Fruit was doing, and there was then they, after they took all the bananas away, there was a big pile of yellow bananas. And he said, what do you do with those? And they said, we throw them in the garbage because nobody can get them to market before they rot. And his whole gamble was, I can, you know. And then the fact is you get bigger and bigger and you go down to these countries and you get enmeshed in the culture of the business of those countries. And when you have a product like bananas, and it sounds like your grandfather's product, and it's very, very inexpensive product, you know that somebody's paying for it somewhere. And it's usually the workers in those countries. That's how it's done. And that's why I say sort of getting so mad at Zemmoury for what United Fruit did 50 years ago, well, as right now, if you read in the newspaper about what Walmart's been doing in Mexico, it's the exact same thing. If you think this stuff isn't going on right now, you're not really – don't have your eyes open.
It's, as you point out, though, quite a formidable task to be selling bananas 6 hours before they're rotted.
Well, if you want to become – the greatest salesman in the world, try selling a product that if you don't sell it, it turns into mush in 6 hours. It would make you a fantastic salesman.
Malcolm, thank you for your call. He also had a lot to do with innovations in banana growing and all that with respect to the industry.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Another thing about him, the flip side and all that, is that he grew up on a farm and he always considered himself to be a farmer. Until he was an old man, and he had a big sort of plantation in Louisiana where he grew a lot of different things. And he had a lot of – he built a better company than United Fruit, not because it made more money. It made less money, and it was smaller, but it had a better product, which is crazy because you see a banana and you think, that's perfect. You don't think, I see room for improvement. But he actually saw room for improvement, and he did it through various ways of, you know, irrigating, building canals, letting fields lie fallow. And during the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt learned about what Zemmoury had done and actually made him the head of some of the agricultural commissions trying to deal with the Dust Bowl and everything going on with the farmers in the United States.
Talking again with Rich Cohen, and his new book is The Fish That Ate the Whale, and our next caller is Chris. Chris, you're on.
Hi. I just wondered, Mr. Cohen, if you've read the book Overthrow by Stephen Kinzer. It had one of its sections talked about Zemmoury and in Honduras and, you know, how the U.S. was influential in changing the government there. And the interesting thing about the book Overthrow is it kind of chronicles the U.S.'s interventions in other countries. And I just wonder if you've read the book and you thought that might be, if you have, if you've thought that might be a good follow-up to your book.
Yeah, I did read the book. In fact, I had dinner with Stephen Kinzer a couple weeks ago because I admire him so much. And he wrote this other book, which is this, a great book called Bitter Fruit, that's really about United Fruit in 1954, not so much about Zemmoury, with Stephen Schlesinger, who is Arthur Schlesinger's son. Mm-hmm. And they really sort of talk about how 1954 happened. But Stephen Kinzer had an amazing quote. I think it's from Overthrow, not from Bitter Fruit, where he said what it took an army of people to do, I think in Nicaragua, Samuel Zemmoury did with just a couple of mercenary soldiers in Honduras for almost no money.
He should have been leading the Contras, huh?
Yeah. But yes, that's a really outstanding book by an outstanding historian.
Yeah, I thought one of the really fascinating characters in it, who was new to me, was John Foster Dulles and how influential he was. Maybe you could write your next book about him. He's a pretty fascinating character.
Yeah, well, I would do the Dulles brothers, Alan and John Foster, because together they, you know, you have the Secretary of State and the head of the CIA as brothers. It's a pretty powerful block.
Well, in fact, and thank you, Chris, for your call. Here's a listener, Cliff, who writes, it was my understanding that both the Dulles brothers were very anti-Semitic, particularly around the time of the early 20th century and the oil exploration of the Middle East, and I find it incredulous, their association with your guest's view of their involvement with the Banana King. Would you comment?
Well, they were really involved originally with United Fruit, and I don't know about them being anti-Semitic. I mean, I assume that a whole lot of people were anti-Semitic before the Second World War that weren't as anti-Semitic after the Second World War, starting with Ernest Hemingway, you know? It just depends on – there was a certain kind of social country club anti-Semitism, which is – and Zemmoury, like Peter, his nephew, said – that Zemmoury had to deal with all the time. When he went to Boston after he bought United Fruit and he wanted to buy a house to live near the other
– covenants.
Yeah, to live near the other – yeah, exactly. They had gentlemen's agreements like in the movie. So he tried to buy – I think even like Brookline, which seems crazy now, and they wouldn't sell him a house because he was Jewish. So he said, to heck with it. And instead he rented like the top floor of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and charged it to the company. But – Zemmoury had a deal all his life with all kinds of people that were you and might consider didn't want to be around Jewish people socially, but it doesn't mean you don't do business with them and aren't involved with them, especially if they're running United Fruit. That's the reality of the world, you know, and that's also the reality of America. These guys weren't doing business with each other because they didn't want Jews in their country club. That's just the way that it was. And like I said, in New Orleans, even the German Jews didn't want the Russian Jews in their country club.
Even Mel Gibson had to work in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. There's a listener, Walker, who writes, excellent conversation. Love the history. Thank you for writing this book. I myself have spent several months in Central America, and I enjoyed some of the greatest times of my life. Much of that was through experiences working with small farmers and NGOs who were making great strides for changing the paradigm towards socially and environmentally sustainable ways of farming bananas, coffee, etc., and employing the people of those countries. I'd like to hear your guest comment on his experiences in the countries of Latin America. Were they positive experiences? I believe it's important that those of us who have traveled there not only tell the story of past corruption and danger, but also express the progress and positive aspects of these beautiful places and people.
Well, I spent most of my time in Honduras, because that's where Zamora was based. And, you know, it's funny. I read in the paper that Honduras has the highest murder rate in the world, and the drug war is being pushed from Mexico south, and Honduras is in jeopardy because of that.
They also have no standing army, right?
No, that's – I think that's Panama.
I thought – well, anyway,
there's guys walking out. They have army. And, you know, it's like you read it in the newspapers, and then you go there, and you realize mostly what it is a lot of – people living their everyday lives, which are sort of more powerful than anything, that force. And I thought Honduras was one of the most beautiful countries I ever lived in. So, I mean, yeah, I sort of lived in and never wanted to leave and actually thought maybe I should buy a house down here. First of all, it's incredibly affordable, probably not for good reason. So, but, and it's full of, this is an interesting, weird little thing. There's a lot of retired, I'm from Chicago originally, a lot of retired Chicago cops in Honduras living on their pensions.
A lot, really.
Well, that I met more than a few.
Ghetto Chicago cops?
Yeah, we talked about the bears and everything.
Wow. Here's Merrily, who says, I just got back from Cuba. United Fruit had a big role there during the Batista rule. Did Zamora play a role there, too? Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, well, the thing about United Fruit was they realized that the banana crop could be in jeopardy if there was hurricane storms. The United Fruit was sort of born in the year 1899 when the whole banana crop was wiped out, and they called it the year without bananas. And they realized they had to plant bananas all over the place, and they needed a hedge in case something went wrong. That hedge was sugar. So they didn't grow bananas in Cuba, but they grew a lot of sugar in Cuba. And the second thing after Batista was pushed out, the first thing Castro did was nationalize the telephone company for obvious reasons. And the second thing was all of United Fruit's property. And that was already sort of the end of Zamora. He was basically gone by then. He was alive, but he was sick. And that led to sort of the Bay of Pigs and everything else. But it's interesting. If you watch The Godfather Part 2, they have a meeting which they show where they have the telephone company and General Fruit. And our friend Meyer Lansky. Oh, no, Hyman Roth, excuse me.
Yeah, Hyman Roth. He's the godfather, nom de plume. What? You know, Cuba imports a lot of sugar now. And in fact, because I was there just about a year ago, I was amazed at how much they import that they don't do themselves anymore. I mean, it's kind
it's
of
incredible,
sad
you know,
in many ways.
Barbados, because I wrote a story about sugar for National Geographic magazine. Barbados, which had been the big sugar island for the British, now has to import refined sugar. They don't refine their own sugar.
Let's refine a few more calls here. Anna, let's have you join us. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have to say, I think, well, I appreciate the research you've done in this book, and I think it's an important topic. The narrative to me is incredibly problematic. Can you seem to a certain degree glorify and apologize for somebody who participated in an incredibly bloody and horrifying history? I mean, we're talking, when you take just Guatemala, we're talking 300,000 dead, 1 million forced, 1 million refugees, incredible cultural and ecological devastation, and genocide of indigenous people, and the practices of the banana companies in Latin America directly led to this death. And it seems to me the way you sort of glibly talk about this person's life is incredibly insensitive to the people who lived through torture and violence and disappearance and death. And I'm a little bit horrified.
I don't think that, I mean, you have to really look at Samuel Zamora and what he did. He wasn't involved in...
It doesn't
in,
matter. If
it, doesn't what, ma- it doesn't matter, so we're not supposed to know about his life?
Yes. No, I think it's important to know about his life. I totally agree with you on that. What I'm saying is the narrative is problematic because, you, and to a certain degree, from what I haven't read your book, but from what I'm hearing you say, you're, to a certain degree, an apologist.
I'm not apologizing. Look, first of all, had you heard of Samuel Zemuri?
Yes.
So you knew his story?
I didn't know his story, not to this detail.
I mean,
no.
To me, Samuel Zemuri is a guy most people have never heard of, so I'm not apologizing for him. But the thing is, it's very easy to sort of say this guy was an outlander and an evil, evil person and this, that, and the other, and let's dump all our sin on him and he'll stand for it.
No,
he's very central in American history. I'm not apologizing for him. I'm attempting to tell his story.
Yeah, but in the same way, you're sort of glorifying this Teddy Roosevelt-like figure.
Okay, so you love Teddy Roosevelt? Wait, do you love Teddy Roosevelt?
No, I don't.
You like Teddy Roosevelt?
Glorifying. No, of course not.
Do you think Teddy Roosevelt is a bad guy?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so...
Yeah,
you just,
I think you're sweeping under the rug the violence and the horror of that he participated in. And that narrative is incredibly problematic to me.
I just think it's important to look at the actual history, who he was, who United Fruit was. He did not start United Fruit. He did not build United Fruit. He took over United Fruit. And it's important.
But he was an actor in this company that led to the genocide of thousands of people. And it seems to me... The problem that I have is that you don't seem to be telling their story. You know, their story.
Well, there's no denial, and the book really faces the history that you're talking about. I think the book faces the history that you've just described, Anna, if I may. But I think maybe the indictment here, if that's what I'm hearing from her, I think it is more for maybe being enthusiastic about Zemuri. Maybe you're supposed to be a kind of researcher who's not enthusiastic about a villain.
I mean. Because I see it as more complicated than that. I don't see him as behaving differently than most American businessmen and tycoons of that era. I don't see him as largely different than guys that operated outside the country or even the oil companies that operated in Iran from British Petroleum or whatever it is. What they did was really wrong. And evil, and the secondary effects were truly evil. When you're talking about genocide and everything else, you're talking about something that happened after Sam Zemuri was mostly dead. Okay, so we're talking about horrible things that happened down the line as secondary effects for things that not just United Fruit, but the CIA and the U.S. government was involved in. But that's the complicated thing about American history. Now, to sort of say there was nothing exhilarating about his story and we need to say he was evil and awful from the moment he stepped foot in this country, I just think misunderstands the natures of people's lives and how certain things happen. I think that... That's why he is sort of he's both sides. You know, there was something, people loved him. Franklin Roosevelt loved him. Felix Frankfurter said he was the greatest person he'd ever met. He wasn't the personification of evil type guy. That's what's interesting about him. He was complicated, and what the company was involved in, often before he was around, really was evil and had evil effects, but it's more complicated than just let's make him a devil. Let's tell the whole story. And try to understand American history and what happened over the last 100 years than just sort of throwing it behind a wall.
Well, and I thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here. That's you, Nathaniel. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Nathaniel Berkowitz. I live in Sausalito. And Sam Zemuri played a big factor in my family's life and especially a factor in my own. I knew Sam. I had lunch with him one day in Boston when I was a student at Harvard. And he was a dynamite of a guy. He had been a friend. My grandfather, who was in the fruit business, was a customer and a card-playing friend of Zemuri. As a result of that, when in the middle of the Depression, my mother got married. They went to New Orleans, and Zemuri asked them, "Where are you going on your honeymoon?" And they said, "We can't go very far because we don't have much money." Sam said, "Well, take a trip on one of the banana boats." So he put them on a boat called the Kamiaga, and they did the trip from New Orleans to Central to Honduras and then Panama.
Uh-huh.
About 15 or so years later, I wrote Zemuri a letter and said I would like to work on one of the fruit boats. And I got a response which says, come on down. And I did come down, and as a 15-year-old kid, I got a job working as a mess boy on one of the banana boats. I later spent a week at Puerto Berrios and went to one of the at Bandera, which was one of the farms in Guatemala, where I had an opportunity to do a little work, but really to see what it was all about. And believe me, there was a hospital, rather poor by today's standards, but the fruit company took care of the people and their families. It was health insurance. Zemuri was really a very interesting guy. And as you know, I have a very fond spot in my heart, even today at the age of 80, for this gentleman from the old school.
Well, it's good of you to call, Nathaniel. And it's a complicated picture,
it's
obviously.
A nice juxtaposition.
Yeah, it is a great juxtaposition. Thank you for that call. And thank you, Rich Cohen, for spending this hour with us. Congratulations on the book. Again, the book is The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Well, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. You can always let us know about what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website. You can continue this discussion, a fascinating discussion about Samuel Zemuri, on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Tina Lauberg, Amy Machado, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Paul Ancour, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.